This morning I'm going to speak on, or read from, something from some of the many conversations of Srila Prabhupada that were recorded. Srila Prabhupada, in the course of discussion with his disciples, often his disciples and others would bring very interesting points concerning philosophy, the practical application of Krishna consciousness, and many varied topics which are not directly addressed in scripture. And then we have to think, then, how do we see through the eye of Shastra if everything's not described in Shastra? Now that requires some realization. And certainly Srila Prabhupada was fully competent to explain everything in terms of Shastric knowledge. The following is from a morning walk that Srila Prabhupada took with some of his disciples on October the 13th, 1975, in Durban, South Africa. There's a question from Pushta Krishna Swami. Not exactly a question, but an observation which he brought out for Srila Prabhupada to consider. It's just that people have taken India as a model of our philosophy, and sometimes people judge our philosophy by India's practical application. You won't get this kind of query in India so much, but outside of India, people understand the Krishna conscious movement to be something of India, and they think, well, look, India is such a mess, why should we adopt their religion? That's one reason why Christianity is making inroads in India, because people tend to think, well, it's the religion of successful countries, countries that are well developed economically. And all the culture, if you can call it that, in the world, mostly comes out of India, out of Hollywood. Out of the West, the anti-culture. So that's a valid observation. But before Srila Prabhupada said anything about that, another devotee, Bhargava, brought in a more specific question. And this is very interesting, and this you get asked in India also. Why did Krishna allow the Muslims to enter and do so much damage to the Vedic culture? Right? Good question, huh? Krishna wants to protect Dharma. So why didn't Krishna step in when the Muslims were entering India and doing so much damage to the Vedic culture? Literal damage in destroying temples, killing Brahmins in particular, so many things. Srila Prabhupada's response was, as in many cases, unpredictable. Srila Prabhupada said that, is Krishna your father's servant that you do something wrong and Krishna has to check it? In other words, Srila Prabhupada thinks that the question is inappropriate. Is Krishna your father's servant? Do you understand this? Your father's if in the house, if there's a domestic servant is there, you just tell them, hey, do this, do that, do that. Why do you ask this question? Srila Prabhupada thought the very question was not even appropriate to ask. If you allow somebody to cut your head, has Krishna to come to save you? Why do you ask this nonsense question? It's something like devotees, sometimes I ask them, well, put the seatbelt before you drive. And say, no, I already chanted Nrsingha mantra. So now I didn't put the seatbelt and Nrsingha is obliged to protect me, even though I don't take the necessary cautions. Something like that. You are Krishna conscious. Samoham sarva bhuteshu. It's interesting that Srila Prabhupada quoted this here, that Krishna sees all equally, sees all living beings equally. So he may give the aggressors the chance also. If you cut your own head, what will Krishna do? In the same term, nationalism, as Vedic culture is, as if Krishna, Vedic culture is Krishna's national affair, your disease is there. Why will Krishna come to save the Vedic culture? What business has he got to do that? If you're spoiling it, then why will Krishna come? Spoil and suffer. The same question in a different way. Why India? Why Krishna? As if Krishna is Indian. Krishna is Indian? Then why do you ask this question, that Krishna will come to save India's culture? And then Bhargava said, not the Indian culture, but the Vedic culture, Krishna's culture. And actually he didn't mention, Bhargava, when he said, he didn't mention Indian culture, he said Vedic culture. But he did say, why did Krishna allow the Muslims to enter? So that means enter India. And prior to Srila Prabhupada's taking Krishna consciousness all over the world, Vedic culture was practiced primarily in India, not only in India. So Prabhupada responds to this. Yeah, it's Vedic culture, Krishna's culture. But Srila Prabhupada again puts the blame on those who are not following. He says, Vedic culture, he has given Bhagavad Gita. Why don't you accept it? You don't accept, then suffer. He has given his instruction. The government gives you the law. Now, when you violate, will the government come to stop you? You violate and suffer. Why do you expect that when I violate the laws, the government men will come and stop me? Why do you expect like that? The government can give you the law book. You consult and do accordingly, you'll be happy. And if you don't, act against. The government man is not coming to stop you. You do and suffer. Krishna says, whenever there is discrepancy, I come. That is general, not for India. Vedic culture is not for Indian. It is for everyone. So Srila Prabhupada's point is here that the Muslims are able to come because the people weren't following Vedic culture properly. Of course, they were following to some extent. Even now in India, people are following to some extent. But punishment for not following, more or less Srila Prabhupada saying that's what's going on. Why will Krishna protect you if you don't follow? Just like the government will protect the citizens, but if there are two gangs of criminals, why is the government inclined to protect either of them? They may let them fight among themselves. It's now here's another question which came up after a Bhagavatam class in London in 1971, August 1971, by an Indian man who asked this question in London. 1971 was the year of Bangladesh's independence, which was preceded by a genocidal policy of the West Pakistanis against the East Pakistanis. East Pakistan became Bangladesh. And that all ended when the Mukti Jodha Bahini conquered. The Mukti Jodha Bahini means the Liberation Army of Bangladesh, which was mostly staffed by Indian Army people, actually. Otherwise, the Bengalis, they couldn't stand up to the big Punjabis and Pathans of the West Pakistan Army. Anyway, it was a big issue at the time that there was genocide going on in East Pakistan, now called Bangladesh. That had ended at that time. So this Indian man who's asking this question, that he's, first of all, expressed his appreciation that Krishna consciousness is being spread around the world. And then he says, there were many Krishna devotees in that part of the world which is now called Bangladesh. I can attest to that. I went there after the Gondagal Shamai, as it's called in Bangladesh, the disturbed period. And there were still many, many Hindus. It's, in fact, Bangladesh has got the second largest population of Hindus of any country in the world. No prizes for guessing which is number one. But you might think that number two is Nepal, maybe. But actually there are more Hindus in Bangladesh than in Nepal. So, he said there are many Krishna devotees, and Hindus, and most of them are the East Bengal Hindus. They're mostly devotees of Krishna. They identify themselves, or they're more inclined to worship Krishna. Whereas in West Bengal, I didn't do any census, but it must be about half and half Vaishnav and then Shakta. Shakta means worshippers of Durga and Kali and tantrics and nowadays atheists also. Many atheists in West Bengal, not in Bangladesh. You'll hardly find an atheist in Bangladesh. So many Krishna devotees and millions of Krishna devotees, all sons of Krishna, are being butchered by West Pakistan. What is your answer to this sort of genocide or greatest man-made disaster? Srila Prabhupada replied, that is going on since the creation. How can you stop it? History repeats itself. This butchering, this attack by one country by another or one king to another is going on. This is the nature. Therefore it is called Dukhalayam Ashashvatam. This is a place simply for suffering. Therefore, everyone's business is how to get out of it. You cannot stop what is going on in Bangladesh. It may be in Bangladesh, or it may be in Vietnam, or it may be in some other places. This is nature's law. It will go on. You cannot stop it. The best thing is to get out of the scene. That is your business. You cannot stop it. Even if you show sympathy, that is useless, because this is the way of nature. Yada yada hi dharmasya paritranaya vinashaya tadushkritam. The vinash is there. The two things are going on, maintenance and dissolution and creation. So you cannot stop the process. And in the Bhagavad Gita it is said, yang hinavya tantyete purushang purusharshaba. All these ephemeral things which come and go, if one is not disturbed by all these things, then he is the right candidate for liberation. Yeah. What is that verse? Yang hinavyatante purushang purushashaba. Samadukha sukham dhiram somritatvaya kalpate. One who is not disturbed by the inevitable happiness and distress, he is eligible for amrita, for nectar. So I was often asked that why when I was in Bangladesh. Why did Krishna allow there were so many Krishna devotees? But I would say that, well, I would tell people that Krishna devotees, but willingly doing wrong things, especially fish eating was very prominent, still is, among these supposed Vaishnavas, and many wrong ideas, which offensive ideas. There was one sampradaya, Kalachan sampradaya, in which the guru enjoys the wives and daughters of his disciples. Of course, that was not very much appreciated by others, but the sex in the name of religion in various ways, and especially this fish eating was very widespread. Very widespread means it was very difficult to find anyone, even if they were expert mridanga players, superb singers of kirtan, who didn't eat fish. So it's a similar kind of response. why did this happen? And Prabhupada said, it's your fault, because you didn't follow properly. You may think, well, then Krishna should step in to set it right. Well, he does when he's ready for do. You can't say, okay, Krishna, we're not following properly, it's time for you to come. But when he comes, he kills the demons. It's not that he, as Srila Prabhupada points out, it's not that he forces anyone to follow his culture. But if we don't follow, then we suffer. That's inevitable. Dharma eva hato hanti dharmo rakshita rakshitaha. Manu says that if we kill dharma, if we don't properly follow, then we will be killed by dharma. And if we protect dharma, then we will be protected by dharma. So that is the specialty of the Vedic culture. And as is noted, it's a notable fact that despite 1,000 years of foreign rule by Muslims and then by Christians, the Vedic culture has survived somehow or other. I mean, when I say somehow or other, I mean in some form or other. It's not in a very pure form. But it's going on in what we call Hinduism. So how is that possible? When the people were conquered, in the case of the Muslims, by a very violently proselytizing force that wanted to convert. Well, it wasn't that all the Muslim rulers were extremely inimical to Vedic culture. Many of them were, but just for the sake, if they want to settle down and enjoy the country, then they have to rule it. If you just kill everyone, then there's no one left to rule. And who's going to carry your palanquin if you just kill everyone? Who's going to cook your meal? Who's going to give you taxes? If you kill everyone, then there's no... The wealth that they came for, who's going to generate that? How are they going to enjoy the place? So they didn't, although there were many atrocities during the period of Muslim rule, they didn't have a totally genocidal policy. They were different. There were different rulers. Some were worse than others. But the point is that the Muslims and then the British were ruling and they had the strength to rule over. Then how did the Vedic culture have the strength to survive at all? One question is, how did these people come in? They weren't the followers of Vedic culture. They weren't strong enough to keep them out. They weren't physically or militarily strong enough to keep them out, but they had enough strength of purpose and strength of mind to maintain their culture for many generations. Of course, there are many converts to Islam also. Not much to Christianity. When the British were present, there wasn't much conversion. That it really started later. It's going on rampantly now. But obviously, a civilization needs strength to survive. Civilization, what exactly constitutes civilization? It's one of those abstract terms which is difficult to fully define, to precisely define. But generally when we think of civilization, we think of a stable society run with law and order, in which everyone more or less cooperates. And especially what is called the great civilizations of the world, they also were wealthy. They generated much wealth. So one factor in a civilization's survival is military strength. Even to become even to become a great civilization. Well, a great civilization, and we also think of empires, although India never had an ambition to conquer other, go out and make a big empire beyond India. That's interesting, isn't it? They didn't have this ambition to conquer other nations. They remained, they're powerful kings, but they remained within India.
Mm.
So military strength, that is required, because if you have a strong economy, if you have a rich cities and all kinds of things that people like to possess, gold, jewels. One thing we find in developed civilizations is textiles, perfumes, spices. These are things that India became known for and incited the greed of outsiders. Then you also require a strong military force to protect that. So military strength is required. And moral strength is required also. If the whole society or the majority of the society is dedicated simply to enjoying the senses, which is what usually happens after some time, then they won't have the strength to stand up against belligerent invaders or aggressors. If people are used to just having orgies and drinking lots of alcohol, then where are they going to get the strength of spirit to stand up and risk their life and limb to resist invaders? And actually, that is the history of civilizations. So they start off very disciplined, very moral and principled, usually very religious, and then they become strong, and often they conquer other countries and have a big empire. And then the next generation or subsequent generations, they don't have to do any conquering. They're already on top. And they just presume their superiority over others. And they enjoy the fruits of their forefathers' military expeditions. And they enjoy it by enjoying the senses. They become indulgent in that way. And then they lose their any determination to fight, and then they get taken over by someone else, and then that someone else comes up strong, and it goes on like this. This is the history of civilizations. So civilizations need strength to survive, both military strength and moral strength. At the present time, military strength largely derives from technology. So it may be seen that you don't need moral strength. We'll see how that plays out in the course of history that we're presently living in. Of course, there are other factors also, because just like in Afghanistan, no one's ever been able to, no outside invaders have ever been able to subjugate Afghanistan. One reason is because of the terrain, it's very mountainous, and so people can dodge in and out of the mountainous terrain. And also the people themselves are of indomitable spirit. Russia also very difficult to overcome, just because of the vast size and the vast distance between the main population centers of Russia and anything to the west or east, or the north or south, especially to the west. The two major invasions after Genghis Khan were from the West. So civilization needs strength, and the strength of Vedic civilization was dharma. This is a very important point to understand, that the strength of Vedic civilization was not merely in military strength. It was not merely economic strength, although they did have competent kshatriyas. And economically, India was so much progressed that people were coming from different parts of the world for trade. Christopher Columbus supposedly discovered America. The people who were living there previously presumably weren't considered enough of human beings. So it's said that Christopher Columbus discovered America. But he was looking for a passage to India. He thought, maybe if I sail west far enough, I'll get to India. And from England, from Holland, from Portugal, from France, traders were coming from Italy, from Arabia. They're coming by ship to trade with India, because India was reputed to be fabulously wealthy. But the strength of Vedic civilization, which kept it surviving all these years, was dharma, which is a very difficult concept to define, to explain, or even to fully understand, because it's a multi-leveled concept. The basic definition is dharmaṁ hi sākṣāt bhagavat pramītam. Dharma means to follow the laws given by God, but it also entails an understanding of how God acts in this world, how we are meant to act in this world, what is the purpose of life, how everything is orchestrated by God. So this understanding, it meant a very different civilization to that in other countries. Just like the French people considered themselves very civilized. I'm talking about maybe the 17th or 18th century, when they used to use perfumes, a lot of perfume. The aristocratic people used to use a lot of perfume, eau de cologne, water of cologne, somehow or other it's called that, which they thought was very advanced to put on perfume, because they never took a bath. So they smelled very bad. And after passing stool and urine, they never wash up or clean up or anything. So they thought, now we're very civilized because we're putting on this perfume, so we can't smell us. We smell nice over the bad smell. So that's a very different concept of civilization to that here in India, where at least until recently, everyone, first thing in the morning, they take a bath. That's why in Indian homes, middle-class homes, they have at least two bathrooms and toilets. In the West, you'll only find one. Why is that? Because everyone needs to take a bath at the same time, early in the morning. I used to see in Calcutta, this would be the 1970s, that on the street in different places, they'd have some water pipes, and the water would come out, and it was all broken and everything. Pretty much everything in Calcutta was broken at that time. So you see the rickshaw wallahs, they're pulling the rickshaw by hand. They'll be there, they'll be sitting underneath taking a bath, and as the water's spouting out, everyone will take a bath. And that's the first thing in the day, and there's so many observances, so many things. which people would follow with the idea that this living like this is civilized. This is living in accord with the dictates of Shastra. And they really couldn't understand this, how Muslims, later Christians, their spirit of wanting to convert others by force, because the whole atmosphere, or the whole understanding, was very liberal in terms of religion. People, all kinds of things were allowed. Cow killing was generally not allowed. Animal killing was allowed, not for everyone. Not for Brahmins. But lower class people, they would kill animals in a sacrifice and then eat them, not every day. There was a lot of agitation that the lower caste people, or they should be allowed to enter temples, all the temples, but actually they didn't even want to, because they had a different system of worship anyway. They had their own gods who they'd sacrifice chickens and goats, and if they're really wealthy, a buffalo too. And they didn't want to go in, and they knew that anyway, this is just like at our temple in Salem, the local people, they don't like to come to our temple because they eat meat. And they think, if I have to go to the temple, at least I shouldn't eat meat on that day, isn't it? And they don't want to enter, because then they know we're not supposed to enter. So there's a very strong sense of dharma, even among the low-class people. Low-class people means those who didn't follow at a very high level. They might drink and eat meat, and drink alcohol and eat meat. And within Vedic culture, there's plenty of sense enjoyment also. Varanasi is famous for its religious culture and renunciation of the Mayavadis. But it's also famous, it's also been a city of highly sophisticated sense enjoyment. The two things go on side by side, with the understanding that different people are different people are at different levels. So at some level they may enjoy the senses, and then they may get fed up with that and then renounce. But when someone's in the mode of enjoying, they should be allowed to do that. And there's a way to do that within the bounds of dharma. Of course, we who are preaching Krishna consciousness, we don't recommend that. Because sense enjoyment, after all, is a waste of time, and it binds us in this material world. So we're trying to get people to make the jump from the platform of enjoying sense enjoyment to that of renouncing sense enjoyment for the sake of practicing Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, there's allowance within Vedic culture and within Krishna consciousness. If someone wants to enjoy sex life, that's allowed within married life. It's not disallowed. It's encouraged. Once you get married, it's encouraged. Have children. Look after them. Be Krishna conscious. Have a comfortable home. We don't say, don't have a comfortable home, but be Krishna conscious. So, in these two exchanges, in these conversations, Srila Prabhupada indicates that the weakening of dharma made conquest possible, because people were not properly following. Therefore, the result was that that instead of dharma rakshati rakshitaha, instead of being protected by dharma, dharma eva hato hanti, that those who make a mockery of dharma, those who kill it, or those who don't properly follow it, they will be destroyed by dharma. So The dharmic culture is one of kshurasya dhara nishita durateya. It's a difficult one. It's like a razor's edge. If we don't properly, if we're not careful when shaving, of course, traditionally in Vedic culture, people didn't shave themselves. The barber would do so. But if the barber makes a slip, he's got the job of being a barber because he's not meant to slip. He should do his job perfectly. But if he doesn't do it properly, then he'll, instead of shaving, which is a good service to do, then he may cut you. So it's a razor's edge. Spiritual life is like a razor's edge. So Vedic civilization is different to others. It's not just some other. It's just like generally people think that Darwinian evolutionary theory and then humans, they descended from apes or some common ancestor. Then they learned to... Originally they were hunters and gatherers. Eventually they started having agriculture and then society developed. But it's not like that. This is all a... some idea based on some fairy story or mythology of man being a product of biological evolution. Rather, the Vedic culture is Sanatana Dharma. Within this world, it's always going on. But in Kali Yuga, it declines. There's a time for that also. People also ask, why does Krishna allow so many cows to be killed? Well, demons do that. It's not only in Kali Yuga, but in other ages, whenever demons like Hiranyakashipu or Kamsa become prominent, they kill many cows deliberately to spite the brahmanas and the demigods. So Krishna loves the cows, but the demons, they also get their opportunity to be demoniac. So Krishna allows them to be demoniac. And then how can they be demoniac when people don't strictly follow dharma, then adharma gets the opportunity to enter. So it's all quite complex, but here Srila Prabhupada indicates that it's our own weakness that makes this possible. We may say also in ISKCON, well, why in ISKCON is there so much deviation? Sometimes when Srila Prabhupada, such questions were put to Prabhupada, he would put it back on the speaker and say, well, why don't you follow properly? You follow properly first. Subal was there in Vrindavan when the ISKCON temple there was just a building site, and he was very disturbed. He said, oh, these devotees here, they're not properly Krishna conscious. Prabhupada said, you set a right example. You show the way. You do it properly. So any deviations in ISKCON, well, we should put our own life together properly first. Let us properly show. We can't force anyone to practice Krishna consciousness as we understand it should be practiced, but at least we can follow ourselves. We find, apart from the gross attacks that the Muslims made on Vedic culture, and Christians also, the British, well, they didn't come as Christians but they came as merchants first of all, and then the Christian missionaries followed later. But the attack is still going on. The attack on Vedic culture, which has been well documented in that book, Breaking India by Rajiv Malhotra and Aravinda Neelakantan. Now it's still going on. The intellectual political subversion of Vedic culture. Why are they so much concerned to put down Vedic culture? Why don't they attack Chinese culture, which is also an ancient culture? Indirectly, they recognize that Vedic culture has got certain strength, that it is unique. It's not the same as others. Srila Prabhupada also noted that in 1976 and 1977, when in America there were the attacks on our movement in various ways by people who accused our movement of brainwashing people. They made heavy court cases against our movement. Prabhupada said, that's good. They recognize this movement has got some substance. He said, they're not attacking this transcendental meditation, because transcendental meditation, they don't have any principles. They don't change people's lives. There's strength, there's power in the Krishna conscious movement if followed properly. So let's follow properly. Dharma eva hato hanti dharmo rakshito rakshati rakshitaha tasmad dharmo nahantavyo mano dharma hato avadhit. Dharma if killed, kills. Dharma if protected, protected. Therefore, let us not kill dharma, lest we be killed by dharma. I'll finish there. I have to rush off. Hare Krishna.